and welcome to the lunchroom for today. Good afternoon, and it is Thursday, April the 17th, 2025. It's Holy Thursday, and this is program number 1358 of the lunchroom. I'm your host, Calix George Jr. Now, of course, in addition to 101.1 FM, you can get us at our website. It's rcistlucia.com. Hopefully, you can check out our previous shows on that platform as well. And we are also streaming live on Facebook. You just have to search for the official page of Radio Caribbean International on Facebook. And be sure to like and share that link as well, please, with your friends and family. We're going to send out some birthday greetings for today. First to Mr. Robbie Skeet, Chef Robbie. And we want to wish him a wonderful and fantastic birthday celebration. Hope he is enjoying it. And we also want to send out some birthday greetings to Ambassador Earl Huntley. Happy, happy birthday to you, sir. And we do hope that you're having a wonderful birthday celebration as well. And also to Miss Claudine James. Happy, happy birthday to you. Hope you're having a splendid birthday celebration. Looking back in time for this day, on April the 17th, in 1492, Christopher Columbus signed a contract with the Spanish monarchs, King Ferdinand II of Aragon and Queen Isabella I, to find the Indies, with the stated goal of converting people to Catholicism, and this promised him 10% of all riches found and the governorship of any lands encountered. In the year 1895, on this day, the Treaty of Shimonoseki was signed, ending the first Sino-Japanese War, which took place between 1894 and 1895. In 1917, on this day, Vladimir Lenin issued his radical April theses, calling for Soviets to take power during the Russian Revolution. 1961, on this day, April the 17th, 1,400 Cuban exiles landed at the Bay of Pigs in a doomed attempt to overthrow Fidel Castro. 1982, on this day, saw the Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau and Queen Elizabeth II signing the Proclamation of the Constitution Act, establishing the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as part of Canada's new constitution. 2011, on this day, Game of Thrones, based on the fantasy novels by George R.R. Martin, premiered on HBO. And on 2012, on April the 17th, the 8th century St. Cuthbert Gospel, the oldest intact book in Europe, was purchased by the British Library for £9 million. We now head across to our dish of the day. The Daily Dish is brought to you the kind compliments of our good friends at Tiles Plus.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need tests for your balcony. Come down to Tiles Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus, Tiles Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A plus, did all kind of tests. Come down to Tiles Plus. We also got gasway and vanity. Boss, boss, you'll see. Come down, don't mind nobody. We got the best tiles on island. Trust me. We are located Lance Road in Castries, Bosses Jou Grozy Lakes, and Slack Street in Dufort. Telephone number 453-7939.
Serving now, the Daily Dish.
And welcome to our program here today at the Lunchroom on Radio Caribbean International. Of course, it is Holy Thursday. It is part of that period entering the Easter Triduum. And of course, yesterday, many Christians would have been participating, or Catholic Christians would have been participating in what is known as the Chrism Mass, the blessing of oils used throughout the year in various functions, whether for the purposes of healing or baptism, catechumens. And so certainly this current period, of course, is a time for the remembrance of the Last Supper and the supper in the upper room in a building in a part of the city of Jerusalem about 2,000 years ago. And of course, it also involves the washing of feet, and it's a time that you would see certainly the various pastors or ministers of religion participating and supplicating themselves to their congregations by washing their feet. And of course, tomorrow, Good Friday, another remembrance of the crucifixion. And then, of course, heading into the glorious Sunday, where Christians mark resurrection of Jesus Christ. So, of course, it's a very special time for many Christians around the world, and a time of remembrance, but of course as well a time of celebration as well. Lots of different feelings and emotions within a very, very short period of time. Now, coming back to yesterday, in fact, in addition to Chrism Mass, which would have been happening at the Minor Basilica of the Immaculate Conception on the Northern Wharf in Castries, an attempt to revitalize part of the city of Castries looking towards the harbor, that was taking place. And of course, we know that Castries has long been, in fact, St. Lucia, one could say, has really been about its harbor. And that was the great appeal of the island in years gone by, that it had a very well-sheltered, deep-water harbor. And that, for, I suppose, Europeans in the 15th century, 15th, 16th, 17th, and certainly 18th, and into the 19th century, was absolutely vital. And, of course, Castries originally taking its name as Carinage, a place where boats could be careened, put on their sides, so that they could be work could be done on maintaining them, cleaning out their hulls. And that's how it certainly began in terms of European settlement. Of course, before that, our indigenous Amerindian ancestors, certainly they had enjoyed the mangroves and the wetland areas and the mudflats of Castries. No doubt it would have been probably a really great place to do fishing and to be able to create a settlement. Unfortunately, we don't have very much of that left. And so Castries has been known about its harbor for quite some time, to the point that, of course, the name of the of St. Lucia, the motto of St. Lucia, even before that of our independence, was a Latin line from a from the poet Virgil, something to the effect of "Statio aud male fida carinis," and translated roughly to mean "a safe harbor for ships." And so it has certainly been a really important asset for the for St. Lucia, to the extent, of course, that it was seen as an excellent place for the British Navy to be able to use as a garrison, a protected garrison. And, of course, that was certainly the case right up into the end of the 19th century, when steamships were at their heyday and coaling was a big business. And of course, we even at one point in time became the 12th busiest port in the British Empire. Of course, those days are all gone, and some can say for perhaps for the better, in the sense that, of course, these the coal industry meant that you had these massive piles of coal on the Northern Wharf and on the different parts of the waterfront in Castries, and it was dirty business, and of course people had to literally carry these baskets of coal on board these ships over time. And so, of course, we certainly don't want to go back to that point, but the bustle and the opportunity certainly for business using the harbor is still something that is quite vital. And so the desire to see the harbor being used for not for military purposes but for leisure and enjoyment has been something perhaps that has been the desire for countries around the world, well, for administrations here in St. Lucia for a bit of time, and the idea being that Castries could become a port that is dedicated to you know, cruise passengers and maybe yachts and that type of pursuit. Now, of course, it does mean that the amenities within the city have to be improved, and certainly the look and feel of the city has to be improved as well. And there have been a number of studies which have been done looking at that. Certainly, some have been done, I think, even in the you could say the colonial period, the pre-independence period. Some work that had been done, for example, by Mr. St. Hill, Nigel St. Hill, who was an architect, and sorry, Leonard St. Hill, who was a town planner, and he did work on the city of Castries and concepts as to how Castries could leverage its waterfront a lot more. I mean, coming out of that, for example, concepts like the waterfront from Sanssouci, from Tougouané, and into the downtown came out of some of those theories, those developments, sketch plans, as they would have been called back then. And there was, in fact, a desire to open out that, continue that waterfront road. Sometimes they're referred to as esplanades or Cornish roads or littoral roads, and to, in fact, continue it all along that the Northern Wharf, so that would, in fact, would become part of the opportunity for people to actually view the waterfront. So if you think of it from the perspective of Jeremy Street, for example, the idea would be that Jeremy Street would then have become sort of like a boulevard, waterside boulevard, which very quintessential of some Spanish cities where they refer to as malecons, right? In Havana, for example, very long, extensive malecon, and even in Georgetown, Guyana, a similar sort of concept of the seawall there too. And so that thinking for Castries was certainly part of a vision. And over time, we also saw additional concepts. The vision plan for Castries, which was done back in, I think, around 1999 by a number of individuals, architects, planners, who were hired to come up with concepts for the city of Castries. And since then, we've been seeing a number of different iterations of these plans, which all kind of have some commonality in certain aspects of it. The desire to have a dedicated cruise port so that you're effectively taking out the cargo operations that exist in the port of Castries right now and relocating them to some other location, be it Cul-de-Sac, be it Vieux-Fort, whatever the case may be, and of course allowing the city to effectively expand, allowing the central business district to expand to incorporate those remaining lands. Of course, and to embellish the city with other amenities, particularly in the issue of pedestrianization of the city. You know, it's a thrust that many towns have gone through over the years. And we see it especially in European towns where you've got relatively narrow roads in these downtowns. And those areas, because they're already very narrow in any case, and they're not very well designed for, they were designed before the advent of the automobile, they really are best suited for pedestrian use. And in the case of Castries, you can think that invariably the town was designed, laid out in the late 18th century, in the 1760s, and it was pre, automobile. And so there are benefits to, in fact, trying to see how to reduce on the amount of vehicular traffic in the downtown area of Castries. And it's also very good in terms of the issue of health. In fact, some cities, like as I mentioned, Paris, which is a very large European city, has been trying to do just that, reducing on the vehicles coming into the city center. Of course, they have a very extensive form of public transportation to be able to support that. And you effectively have people driving to the peripheries and then parking and then having the opportunity to walk. And so effectively your downtown becomes a bit of a large shopping plaza, all right, where people can walk more freely around and about the town. We've been hearing about some proposals, again, some of them coming out of the same Vision 2020 that had been done back in around 1999, and then the Vision Plan, and even most recently, I think there's a Castries Vision 2030, all dealing with these concepts of pedestrianization, on making the environment in the downtown more walkable. And there are certain things that lend themselves to it being very walkable in terms of it's relatively flat. We have a grid system, which has really pretty small blocks, which people can navigate fairly easy around. And those all help in terms of having better walkability. And so that thrust is certainly one of the things that has to be tackled within the context of Castries. So yesterday, an initiative being spearheaded through the Global Port Holdings, which is a private entity which has entered into a public-private partnership with the St. Lucia ANC Ports Authority for the redevelopment of Port Castries, as well a component of that project being executed in the town of Soufré. And, of course, it has been controversial because some, people have been saying, this is a sale of the port. Of course, the government has retorted by saying that it's not a sale of the port, but in fact, it's a PPP. And we have seen, of course, that ports, airports, they tend to be attractive as economic assets, which could potentially gain private sector investment. Utilities as well are one of the areas where you see private sector investment being made. Because in all these instances, there are pretty clear revenue streams that can be had with those types of projects. And so many countries around the world have gone the route of trying to leverage outside capital, leverage foreign direct investment into these infrastructure systems so that, in fact, they can grow and expand. So, of course, when you think about Heathrow Airport and Gatwick Airport, they, in fact, have owners that are not the government of the United Kingdom. They have people who've invested and are investing in the overall development of infrastructures that exist in that country. And the same can be said for a number of other countries which are going down that route. And so the concept here, of course, is that it frees up the government then to look towards investing in other areas that would generally not be able to be financed necessarily by private enterprise. So your things like your hospitals and your schools and your social services and those types of things, government has the responsibility to continue to do so. And that's the general thinking with respect to a lot of PPPs. Of course, we've seen and we've heard about PPP offerings with respect to the Port of Castries before. You would recall both governments entertained the idea of the of Royal Caribbean getting into and making an investment in the Port of Castries, as they have in fact done in other countries in the Caribbean. I think, for example, in the case of Jamaica, I think RCI is involved in the Port of Falmouth in the north coast of Jamaica. Now, of course, Jamaica has a couple of, a number of cruise ports, like Montego Bay, like Ocho Rios, but an investment, a significant investment being made by a cruise operator in the case of Falmouth, where they've created a very large, extensive cruise port. In the case of the likes of Disney, for example, you may have heard of Disney Island in the Bahamas. In Haiti, near Cap-Haïtien, you have the port of Labadie, which has been developed, I believe, through Carnival Cruise. And of course, in right now, with respect to GPH, they have been making investments in the port of Nassau in the Bahamas, which is one of the largest ports by virtue of passenger calls, as well as, I think, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and as well in St. John's, Antigua. So the work in the case of St. Lucia, as we have mentioned, includes, in the first instance, paying off of the government the SLASPA debt, which had been incurred as a result of investments in the port already, but also making some targeted investments in improving things like the a new vendor's arcade and improving the waterfront experience with respect to the boardwalk that they wish to create there. And as well over in Banans, which we, of course, had been speaking to, we spoke of yesterday as well. So let's see how it all pans out, and hopefully it can certainly be to the benefit of the individuals who are very much tied to cruise business, the tour operators, the vendors, the taxi drivers, individuals who provide attractions in various parts of the country. But certainly, the city of Castries, let us hope that it, in fact, can benefit as a whole. Because effectively, what you're talking about is, as of now, I mean, nearly 700,000 passengers coming into the city of Castries on a regular basis, on an annual basis. And if those figures are going to increase, and with the intention of maybe doubling it, you are certainly having a tremendous number of people who are looking to, in the first instance, walk about, right? They're looking to actually explore the city, because a passenger coming on a cruise is not likely to be renting a vehicle. Yes, some of them will be going on excursions, right? And a lot of them will, of course, be looking to go down to Soufre and the attractions down on that side, but there will also be a significant number of visitors who will simply want to be able to walk the city. And there should be something that is attractive and educational as well as inspirational for them, and so that they can get a good sense of the culture of St. Lucia, the history of the country, the heritage of the country. And so certainly let us hope that that is appreciated, and those things within the town, the city of Castries, are in fact worked into effectively the product of Castries. Quite often, and you can think of some of the attractions that people tend to go to in Castries, the Castries Market, of course, being a major one, the Minor Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, the Derek Walcott Square, and maybe the Carnegie Library, right? And so, of course, you can see that there are gaps, and there are areas where we should certainly be looking to improve, right? The overall experience in the city of Castries. Of course, there have been attempts to try to develop new attractions, and certainly, you know, the efforts like, for example, the Walcott House, and trying to rebrand the city towards giving it a theme along the lines of a literary theme, in terms of sharing that experience of the Walcott brothers for the city, is certainly something that could be explored, because people are looking for stories. They're looking to get a good sense of the vibes of a place and the history of a place. And of course, when you've got a Nobel Prize winner in literature who's very well known around the world, and his memory certainly should continue to be honored in something that is beyond just a sculpture in a square, but something that is live, something that is real, something that remembers his drama and his plays. And so certainly there are real opportunities afoot to be able to ensure that Castries is a vibrant cultural space that can in fact attract people. So it definitely needs to be more than sun, sea, and sand. And that's our dish of the day. When we come back, we will be taking in our weather report and then heading to take in some calls.
This has been The Daily Dish.
One test for your home, I see. Bathroom, kitchen, pantry. Need test for your balcony. Come down to Test Plus, satisfaction guarantee. Test Plus, Test Plus, Test Plus. Big test with unbeatable cost. Customer service, A plus. Did all kind of tests. Come down to Test Plus. We also got gasoline and vanity. Box, dust, you'll see. Come down to my nobody. We got the best test on island. Trust me. We are located Lance Road in Castries, Bossejou, Grosley Lakes, and Slack Street in Viewfort. Telephone number 453-7939.
St. Lucia, create it with Island Star Bathroom Bonanza. Bundle and save. From vanities to toilets, shower sets to vanities. Pair them up, triple them up, or buy five or more for 10, 12, and 15% off.
Do something to talk about.
The more you buy, the more you save. Get discounts on selected items like faucets, LED mirrors, cleaners, and more. What more? Bathroom bliss? We're giving you a special introductory offer on toilets starting as low as $240. Island Style Bathroom Bonanza is on at our Castries, Wardney Bay, and Viewfort stores. Call or visit us today.
This is Radio Caribbean International. It's now time for the weather news.
Of course, Solo 1.1 is now time for your weather report as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Style Talamba. The forecast for St. Lucia Valley for the next 24 hours, the winds will be blowing from between the east, southeast, and east near 22 miles per hour or 35 kilometers per hour. The weather fair to partly cloudy skies with a few isolated showers. There is an advisory in the area which reads: small craft operators and sea bathers are advised to exercise caution due to brisk winds and above normal seas. The forecast for Little Sand today is fair to partly cloudy skies with a few isolated showers. And the weather summary: the Atlantic high pressure system will continue to generate moderate to brisk easterly winds and above normal seas across the eastern Caribbean region during the forecast period. generally dry and stable conditions are expected over the Lesser Antilles during the next couple of days. And this was your weather forecast as of 12 noon today, presented by Island Star Telemba.
This has been RCI's Weather News. For more information, call the Weather Hotline at 454-3452. RCI 101 number 1.
St. Lucia, create it with Island Star Bathroom Bonanza. Bundle and save from vanities to toilets, shower sets to vanities. Gear them up, triple them up, or buy five or more for 10, 12, and 15% off.
Do something to talk about.
The more you buy, the more you save. Get discounts on selected items like faucets, LED mirrors, cleaners, and more. What more? Bathroom bliss? Yeah. We're giving you a special introductory offer on toilets starting as low as $240. Island Style Bathroom Bonanza is on at our Castries, Wardney Bay, and Viewfort stores. Call or visit us today.
And welcome back to the Lunchroom here at Radio Caribbean International. Of course, the number to call and tell us what's on your plate today, it is 4523046. And you can also message in via WhatsApp. That is 724-0008. Now, before we get into anything else, I did want to touch on the matter of Creators Alliance. And that has been an ongoing story. And there was some information coming out of Grenada a couple days ago, about 4 days ago, regarding Creators Alliance. And that story just basically said a major breakthrough in the region-wide financial investigation into the defunct Creators Alliance platform unfolded this week, as the Creators Alliance kingpin arrested in Grenada was identified as a Ghanaian national with deep ties to the scheme's regional expansion. The suspect, known as quote-unquote Lillian, was intercepted at Morris Bishop International Airport while attempting to leave the island, and now faces money laundering charges linked to one of the Caribbean's most damaging financial fraud scandals in recent years. Lillian was formally charged on Thursday and appeared before the St. George's Magistrate Court on Friday, where she was denied bail and remanded to Richmond Hill Prison. Next court appearance is expected in the coming weeks. Authorities allege that Lillian was not only a prominent recruiter within Creators Alliance's Grenadian branch, but also played a pivotal role in managing investor inflows through cash for crypto exchanges and false assurances about the platform's legitimacy. The Financial Intelligence Unit of Grenada believes Lillian functioned as one of the top-tier merchants of the Creator Alliance pyramid model, selling investment packages and actively recruiting new members into what was promoted as a digital media referral opportunity. However, officials have confirmed that the platform relied almost exclusively on recruitment rather than genuine product or content monetization, hallmarks of a traditional Ponzi scheme. The platform collapsed on April the 2nd, left thousands across the region. The platform's collapse on April 2nd left thousands across the Caribbean region, including St. Lucians, grappling with significant losses. Grenada alone reportedly saw over 1,500 signups, many of whom funneled life savings or borrowed capital into the high-risk venture. Authorities say Lillian worked briefly with the Grenada Coding Academy as an IT contractor. Earlier this week, Financial Intelligence Unit FIU agents visited the institution to audit her employment and earnings records. A director confirmed she had completed two separate contracts totaling 9 months, but had not been listed on the roster for several weeks prior to her arrest. Multiple individuals who participated in the scheme have described Lillian as one of the most vocal and visible promoters during Creators Alliance's expansion in Grenada. According to regional reports, she allegedly discouraged members from contacting authorities, warning that any official involvement could result in participants being forced to return their earnings. Additional reports suggest she operated as a local cryptocurrency broker, exchanging cash for Bitcoin in person-to-person transactions. These activities are now under investigation as officials work to trace the digital pathways used to funnel illicit funds. Financial Intelligence Unit authorities are also reviewing her travel history across OECS states and her possible links to international accomplices. Early findings indicate that she may have facilitated financial flows through unregulated platforms abroad, including the United Kingdom. The scheme's collapse has further unraveled with the discovery of fraudulent letters bearing the names of UK government agencies, some defunct, that were circulated among Creators Alliance members. The letters falsely claimed tax enforcement issues were behind users' inability to access their funds. Shortly after going offline, the platform briefly reactivated to solicit additional payments under the guise of resolving these issues. Within 24 hours, it vanished again, leaving members without refunds or answers. So it goes on. In the wake of the arrest, investigative agencies across the Caribbean are intensifying efforts to trace funds and dismantle any remaining elements of the Creators Alliance network. The Financial Intelligence Unit in St. Lucia, Antigua, Barbados, and St. Vincent are collaborating to identify key facilitators and recover assets where possible. The arrest of Lillian represents the most significant enforcement action to date in connection with the scandal and has renewed calls for stronger financial literacy education and regulatory oversight of online investments. And so we will, of course, continue to take note of this continuing developing story, which, of course, impacted a number of St. Lucians right here, and, of course, across the Caribbean as well. Of course, if you want to call in to tell us what's on your plate today, you can do that by calling into 452-3046. We've got about 15 minutes to go for, in fact, our final program for this week. Now, of course, this week we usually speak about the matter of resurrection. And, of course, science is progressing rather interestingly in lots of different ways. And certainly one of the matters that has, become a lot more powerful in terms of scientific research and capabilities has been that of genomics. And in particular, we've been able to map the human genome. We've been able to, look at DNA. We've been able to now also even replicate and edit DNA. So gene editing is, in fact, becoming a rather interesting area of research. And some suggest, of course, that that can potentially have significant benefits in terms of medicine and healthcare if it, in fact, is applied appropriately. One of the other areas that you're seeing quite a lot of interest in is the whole concept of de-extinction, and the question being, can you in fact bring something back? Can you in fact, through the sourcing of DNA, and of course that's the other area of research that has become very, very instructive and remarkable, that DNA seems to be a highly resilient form of human life, to the extent that scientists are able to now get DNA that is in fact thousands of years old, captured in the bones or in the teeth of of dead creatures. And that extraction of the DNA has become very, very interesting in respect of whether, in fact, you can now utilize it, replicate it, so that you can, in fact, create things that perhaps don't no longer exist in the world. And so this entire movement of what has been called de-extinction, of course, has very interesting possibilities. Quite recently, in fact, we mentioned earlier on in the program the premiere of a show called Game of Thrones. And it was set back in a fictional world, thousands of years, perhaps in the past, you could say. And one of the creatures that was present in that world, living alongside human beings, was that of the direwolf, a creature which, in fact, used to roam North America. And one entity has now claimed that they have been able to bring this creature back through the use of an existing animal that exists, a relative, you could say, some form of a relative, in that of a gray wolf, and in fact editing the genes within a gray wolf so that it could in fact closer appear to be that or have certain aspects of the dire wolf within that creature. Now, of course, there's been a lot of debate about whether, in fact, they have achieved de-extinction. Many people say that, in fact, they've only really edited about 20 particular markers, and it's not really a true bringing back of the creature. And, of course, there are lots and lots of ethical questions in that regard as well. I think we've got a little bit of I think we've got two clips available. One's a long one. I'm not sure we'll have enough time to actually play that, but let's take a try in doing that. And it speaks to, it's the second clip, I believe. And if we could take a listen about a podcast coming out of Time Magazine, actually, in which one of the scientist is actually being interviewed on the matter of the direwolf.
The howl of a direwolf hasn't been heard on planet Earth for more than 10,000 years. That's because the species is extinct, or was. Colossal Biosciences is a Dallas-based company that's using genetic engineering to de-extinct long-gone species. And this is the first time Colossal's dire wolf pups, who are now 6 months old, have been seen by the public.
Hey, Ben, it's Jeff Kluger from Time Magazine. A pleasure to meet you. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what the goal is for de-extincting and rewilding ultimately. Why are you doing this work?
It became abundantly clear that we need new tools and technologies for conservation. And so we thought this was a really cool way that we could create value, create impact, inspire people, and then also hopefully thoughtfully rewild some of these species, which apparently will also have ecological benefits to these different potential ecosystems.
To try and do that, Colossal needed to understand dire wolves at a genetic level. The company has documented the process from the beginning and shared this footage with Time for a cover story.
So can you tell me a little bit about what went into engineering the dire wolf?
We extracted DNA from two fossils that we knew from previous work had some amount of preserved ancient DNA. One was a 13,000-year-old bone, and the other was a 72,000-year-old bone, an inner ear bone. We were able to generate two genomes, two direwolf genome sequences from that, which we then compared to all the other wolves for which there's already been data generated. And when we do that, we want to figure out where it is that these two dire wolves are similar to each other, but different from the other wolves that are out there. And so we come up with this list of genes where they're distinct. Now, our goal in the Dire Wolf Project, just like with all de-extinction projects, is to re-engineer the core traits, the core characteristics that made these extinct species unique and able to fill whatever role that they filled in their ecosystems when they were still alive.
Using this knowledge, Colossal then made 20 modifications to 14 genes in the DNA of common gray wolf cells. These relatively few tweaks to the genetic code produce some big differences. The dire wolf's white coat, large size, characteristic vocalizations like that howling you heard at the beginning of the story, and more. That DNA was transferred to denucleated egg cells, meaning cells without their own genetic material, and then developed into embryos and were then implanted in the wombs of surrogate mothers, who were hound mixed dogs.
We didn't know how big these embryos would grow and wanted to make sure that the surrogate was healthy. So we picked large dogs.
Romulus and Remus, named after the Roman mythological twin brothers who were raised by a wolf, were born on October 1st, 2024. And in January, they were joined by a younger sister that the Colossal team named Khaleesi. Each wolf is on track to grow to as large as 6 feet long and 150 pounds. Colossal isn't planning to reintroduce them to the wild. Instead, the three dire wolves will live out their lives on a fenced 2,000-acre preserve. Colossal does not want to disclose this location in order to protect the animals.
I think these are the luckiest animals ever. They will live their entire life on this protected ecological reserve where they have all sorts of space and they have natural denning environment and they have an inclement weather hut that they can go and hide out in if they need to. They have 24-hour veterinary care.
Dire wolves aren't the only species on Colossal's de-extinction agenda.
An American company says it has genetically engineered mice so that they have developed some traits like mammoths.
A small but potentially important step in a quest to eventually bring back the prehistoric woolly mammoth.
They hope to de-extinct the woolly mammoth as early as 2028. The company is also hoping to bring back the dodo and the Tasmanian tiger. If some of this genetic tinkering feels familiar, it's because Hollywood has been here first. And spoiler alert, we all know that didn't end well. So naturally, bioethicists have some concerns.
Here, when you're playing with nature, nature usually wins. Nature is much more complicated than the ability of our brains to understand it. Genes do many things. There may be a lot of unintended consequences. Let's say we alter a gene to make extra hair or to make it burn metabolism more, burn fat more. Those genes may do other things in ways that we just don't even understand. So we may create animals that have lots of medical problems. If we start tinkering with genes, we may create a super mouse, a super rat that kills all the other animals around.
But the team at Colossal says their mission to restore extinct species is also about stopping the disappearance of endangered ones today, as experts predict Earth will lose 30% of its genetic diversity by 2050. Colossal has used techniques learned from the Dire Wolf Project to clone four red wolves, a small but important step in fortifying that endangered species. The four new wolves could help inject fresh DNA into the red wolf gene pool, which currently suffers from a so-called genetic bottleneck, the result of too few individuals carrying too little genetic variety to keep the species healthy.
Yes, it would be really amazing to see a mammoth. It would be great for the habitats of Tasmania to have a keystone predator reintroduced into that ecosystem. But the tools that we're developing on the path to these species have immediate application to species that are not yet extinct. A future that is both biodiverse and filled with people, we should be giving ourselves the opportunity to see what our big brains can do to reverse some of the bad things that we've done to the world already.
There's a huge need to help prevent animals from becoming endangered and going extinct. We need to spend more money on conservation. Particularly now, there's a lot of threats that lands that we have as national parks and as preserves are going to be used for drilling oil, for instance. So there's a lot of habitats where species now live that are going to be under threat. So, and there's not enough money to help with conservation efforts.
And that piece, of course, coming from Time magazine on the attempts at de-extinction. And in that instance, of course, trying to bring back a wolf that has been a species of wolf known as the dire wolf that has been extinct for about 10,000 years or so. Of course, there will be continued debate as to how that works out. The argument here is that if we can learn that, then perhaps it can in fact be applied to animals that are still existing today. St. Lucia, of course, we know we have one of the rarest snakes in the world, the St. Lucia racer, and a number of other island endemics. I think we've got about six endemic avifauna, six birds that are unique to St. Lucia, as well as some other creatures out there that one can only find in St. Lucia. There was a belief, for example, whether our fiddlenass is a unique subspecies. There's other creatures out there that are pretty unique to St. Lucia. So, and of course, there are a number of other places around the world that have hotspots for creatures that are endemic and that are facing extinction. And so there are these question marks regarding the utility of this type of work. And some people may say that it will potentially make a significant change in the future as to how we deal with issues. There are many, many issues of creatures that have, in fact, been extinct thanks to human intervention. Good afternoon, Carla. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I just want to know, what is the halls of justice?
The last I heard, there was an interview with Mr. John Peters, and he did indicate that they were exploring a new location, still utilizing part of, well, still utilizing the old education, the former education building, the Ministry of Education, which is at the corner of Miku and Labrie, but instead of going with the High Court site, looking at getting the Ajuda property, which is formerly Gaiety Cinema, and linking those two, so that the area where the old courthouse would then be utilized as sort of an expansion of Constitution Park. So it would become a green space, right? So it'd become a green space for the buildings around that area, I guess. So that is what I think was the last word there that they were in looking at a redesign.
Yes, that's what I could say. They would have to redesign it all over again.
Well, I mean, truth be told, it's redesign of that nature. It might actually be pretty quick, not so difficult, because some of the elements are pretty much the same. Yeah, you got to.
The same height, the same 5 stories or whatever.
Well, my guess is that it might very well be even higher than what they were originally doing. And the reason for that is the size of the... You're actually dealing with a smaller footprint. You have the Gaiety lot is not as large as the other lot that was being utilized, the old courthouse lot.
Okay.
So it may very well mean that they may have to go up an additional floor. I don't know. I have not actually seen the design, so I'm not too sure. But I'm just suggesting that it's possible. It's likely, I would think, that they may very well have to actually look at a slightly taller building even more than what they were originally.
And then what it seems that is on one side and the old education buildings, with the old design, there was supposed to be like some where they can come from one side to another through some.
Right. So there's a sky bridge.
Will they still be having something like that?
My understanding is yes, that they would still be looking to have a sky bridge, probably at the second floor level, to connect the two buildings. But that would then not be over Labrie Street. It would be under a minor street, which is Westall Street. So it would no longer be going across Labrie Street. I mean, I think there were some concerns about Labrie Street in any case, too, being a pretty major thoroughfare. So it's now likely to be going over that Westall Street instead.
But the whole concern was that it was going to, block the church. Was it something like that or the disturbance?
Yeah, I think there were two concerns that were being expressed. One is more from a historic heritage, I suppose, aesthetic expression in terms of, a building that is coming and towering over what is already an iconic building. The cathedral. In fact, all these cathedrals, when they were built originally, if you go back in time, the original entry point into the cathedral was from the square, right? But then in the 1890s, the cathedral has expanded, and so the front of the cathedral then became the Miku Street, right?
Yes. It
became a north-facing cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of a massive structure that completely sort of blocks out the front, which is really supposed to be the prominent aspect of a cathedral, from an aesthetic perspective, it would in my view, certainly raise some question marks as to how that would actually balance out. In places like London, for example, you actually have very strict rules about lines of sight of the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, St. Paul's Cathedral is the principal cathedral in the City of London, and you actually have law. The law is that there are certain places that you must be able to see St. Paul's Cathedral from, right?
Okay.
So, in fact, the buildings in London, many of them are actually designed in such a way that view, those viewpoints, those perspectives are actually preserved, right?
Okay.
So I'm just saying so that in the context of, I know some people don't necessarily appreciate those things, but especially when we're speaking about a city that is supposed to be tourist-oriented and whatnot, you then have to ask, what are people really coming to enjoy and see in the city, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there has to be that balance in terms of
those issues. So you're saying that if it had gone to that height, that people... If you're coming from like the cruise ship coming and they could just coming from by way of Almond Walk, you still would not have seen a sight of the church.
Right. So in fact, there was even a proposal, and I was mentioning that earlier on in the program back in in 1999, and the proposal was actually to create an open space for that entire block from the Prince down to the cathedral, right?
Yes.
Which is, so you're creating the architectural urban planning term is a terminating vista.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a prominent building at the end of an open space, a green space. So from a urban planning perspective, you actually are creating some sort of a walking experience for individuals. And of course, it's a green space, which will help the city, of course. And then, of course, you look at a place like Trinidad and Tobago, for example. They have Brian Lara Promenade, right?
Yes.
So which is a similar kind of concept. And you see that in many, many, many... In fact, if you look at almost every single town in Castries, that actually... in St. Lucia, Labrie, Groselay, you can go down the list of some of them. That kind of concept of, you have... In Soufra, you see it very well. You land at the dock, and then you have this street, and then you've got the square, and then you got the prominent building, which is the church in this instance, right?
Yes, I think I recall when I went to New York, somebody brought me to St. Anne's Cathedral. It's very, very, very big, but there are lots of buildings, but I just realized that I think the ABC News, because this is vast.
Yes.
I think it was about close to that place too, but I just recall that you could have seen the entrance of St. Anne's because it was open from all sides.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very vast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was just saying, but I noticed there were other tall buildings around it, but
yeah.
I just realized it was not long. I was able to walk right into the place, but I also realized it was ABC, which is a vast place right there. But I think now that the green space would do much better now, as I see, because I mean we need more green space in Castries. Yeah, constitutional part.
We definitely do need more green space in Castries.
Yeah,
that is
push it down. Yeah.
And exactly. Yeah. You actually want to have. I mean, and this is what people are not coming necessarily for the concrete. Eh? They're not coming to see. If they want to see skyscrapers, they probably go to Dubai or they want to go to New York. But in the case of that's a big question. You know, what is our architectural style that we are trying to promote? Do we have anything of the sort? In case of Castries, we've lost a lot of our architectural heritage, and we don't have very much.
Yeah.
And so certainly what we still have left of, we should try as much as possible to preserve it. Right?
And that's why I need to ask you a question. Have that green space of Serenity Park been taken away? Because some time ago I read Buffalo and a few other people call Andrea and have a problem with the fact that Serenity Park, the green space was no longer there because of all that what was bidden. I'm told by other people the green space is still there. It's just that they make it a little more. Because example, we look, you have the jazz for the young people coming up,
right.
The stage and certain things.
I think what they did was that they added on an amphitheater or like a stage.
Yes.
And a stage, and I think of a building with, I think maybe some washrooms or something like that. I'm not completely sure what the purpose is. Are you there, caller? Okay, I think we may have lost that caller. Our apologies, but in any case, we're actually over time already. But very, very interesting conversation, no doubt, and we do hope that we can continue to have that next week. And of course, we want to wish everybody a very, very blessed time. I think we're over time already. So we're going to have to end the program. So again, happy Easter to all in advance, and we do hope that we can join you again next week, Tuesday, for another program of The Lunchroom. Have a good one.